Just Carolyn. Things are unraveling right from the center of the skein. That was the worst part. This incredible domination of my feelings. I get in the shower, I drive down the street. It's Carolyn. Fantasies. Conversations with her. An uninterrupted movie. I see her full of relaxed amusement and appreciation of me. Of me. I can't finish a phone call. I can't read a prosecution memo or a brief. And all of it, this whole grand obsession, carried on in the face of a racing heart, a turning gut, a frantic sense of resistance and disbelief. I shudder at random moments. I tell myself that this has not happened. This is a juvenile episode, a mind trick with deja vu. I grope around inside myself for the old reality. I say to myself that I will get up in the morning, feeling unaffected, feeling right again, and sane. But I do not, of course. And the moments when I am with her, the anticipation, the appreciation is exquisite. I feel short of breath and giddy. I laugh too easily, too much. I do what I can to stay near her, show her a paper over her shoulder while she's at her desk so that I can linger with the details of her person, her hammered golden earrings, the odors of her bathwater and her breath, the soft bluish color of her nape when her hair falls away. And then when I'm by myself, I feel desperate and ashamed. This raging, mad obsession. Where is my world? I am departing. I am gone already. Chapter 4. In the dark, the red and blue figure of Spider-Man can be made out on the wall above my son's bed. Life-size, he is poised in a wrestler's crouch, prepared to take on all invaders. I did not grow up reading the comics. It was too light-hearted an activity for the home I was raised in. But when Nat was 2 or 3, we began, each Sunday, to explore the funny papers together. While Barbara slept, I made Nat breakfast. Then, with my son very close beside me, we sat on the sofa in the sunroom as we discussed and recollected the weekly progress in each strip. All the random little boy fury of that age would leave him, and he was reduced to a more essential self, small and full of a transport I could feel through his body. So it was that I came to establish my rapport with the web-slinger. Now Nat, in second grade and almost brittlely self-sufficient, reads the funnies by himself. I must await a moment when I will not be noticed to check on Peter Parker's fate. They really are funny, I explained to Barbara a few weeks ago when I was observed with the comics in my hands. Oh, for crying out loud, muttered my wife, the almost PhD. Now I touch the fine hair, so thin against Nat's scalp. If I fuss long enough, Nat, accustomed by the years to my late arrivals, will probably rouse himself to murmur some gentle appreciation. I stop here first each evening. I have an almost physical craving for the reassurance. Right before Nat's birth, we moved out here to Nearing, a former ferry port to which the city dwellers fled long enough ago that it is called a town rather than a suburb. Although it was Barbara who initially favored this move, by now she would eagerly forsake Nearing, which she sometimes blames for her isolation. I'm the one who needs the distance from the city, the gap in time and space, to manufacture in myself a sense that some perimeter protects us against what I see each day. I suppose that is another reason I was happy to see Spider-Man assume his place here. I take comfort in Spidey's agile vigilance. I find Barbara face down on our bed, largely unclothed. She is breathless, the tight muscles of her narrow back lustrous with sweat. The VCR hums in rewind. On the set, the news has just begun. Exercise? I ask. Masturbation, Barbara answers. Refuge of the lonely housewife. She does not bother a backward glance. Instead, I advance and kiss her quickly on the neck. I called from the bus station when I missed the 8:35. You weren't here. I left a message on the tape. I got it, she says. I was picking up Nat. He had dinner with Mom. I tried to get in some extra time on the mainframe. Productive? A waste. She rolls over and back, breasts girdled in her sports bra. As I undress, I receive a laconic report from Barbara on the day's occurrences. A neighbor's illness, the bill from the mechanic, the latest with her mother. Barbara delivers all this information lying face down on the coverlet in a tone of weariness. This, her drear offensive, a bitterness too tired even to be regret, against which I defend in the simplest fashion, by seeming not to notice. I show interest in each remark, enthusiasm for every detail. And in the meantime, an inner density gathers, a known sensation, as if my veins have become clogged with lead. I am home. About 5 years ago, just when I thought we were getting ready to have another child, Barbara announced that she was going back to school, entering a PhD program in mathematics. She had filed the application and taken the exams without a word to me. My surprise was taken as disapproval, and my protests to the contrary have always been disparaged. But I did not disapprove. I never thought Barbara was obligated to be homebound. My reaction was to something else. Not so much that I was not consulted, but that I really never could have guessed. In college, Barbara had been a math whiz, taking graduate division classes of two or three students with renowned professors, all of them hermit-like creatures with wild-grown beards. But she had been cavalier about her abilities. Now I learned mathematics was a calling, a consuming interest, about which I had not heard a word in more than half a decade. At the moment, Barbara is facing her dissertation. When she started, she told me that projects like hers, I could not possibly explain it, are sometimes set out in a space as small as a dozen pages. Whether those were words of hope or illusion, the dissertation has lingered like a chronic disease, one more source of her painful melancholy. Whenever I pass by the study, she is looking pitifully over her desk, out the window toward a single dwarf cherry tree that has failed to thrive in the clay landfill in our backyard. Waiting for inspiration, she reads. Nothing so much of this world as newspapers and magazines. Instead, she carts in from the university library armloads of heavy texts on arcane subjects. Psycholinguistics, semiotics, Braille and sign language for the deaf. She is a devotee of facts. She reclines at night on her brocade living room sofa, eating Belgian chocolates, and finds out about the operation of the world she never visits. She reads, literally, about life on Mars, the biographies of men and women whom most people would find boring, and certainly obscure. Then there will be a spate of medical reading. Last month she spent with books that seemed to be about cryogenics, artificial insemination, and the history of lenses. What is occurring on these galaxian visits to other planets of human learning is unknown to me. No doubt she would share her newfound knowledge if I asked, but over time I have lost the ability even to pretend high interest, and Barbara regards my dullness to these matters as a failing. It is easier to maintain my own counsel while Barbara roams the far-off realms. Not long ago it occurred to me that my wife, with her abrupt social mannerisms, her general aversion to most human beings, her dark, taciturn side, and her virtual armory of private and largely uncommunicated passions, could be described only as weird. She has virtually no serious friendships, aside from her relationship with her mother, to whom, when I met her, Barbara barely spoke, and whom she still regards with cynicism and suspicion. Like my own mother, when she was alive, Barbara seems largely a willing captive within the walls of her own home, flawlessly keeping our house, tending our child, and toiling endlessly with her formulae and computer algorithms. Without really noticing at first, I become aware that both of us have ceased comment, even motion, and are facing the television set where the screen has filled with images of today's service for Carolyn. Raymond's car arrives and the back of my head is briefly shown. The son is escorted up to the doors of the chapel. The newsreader is doing a voiceover. 800 persons, including many city leaders, gathered at First Presbyterian Church for final rites for Carolyn Polhemus, a deputy prosecuting attorney slain 3 nights ago in a brutal rape murder. Now people are emerging. The mayor and Raymond are both depicted speaking to reporters, but only Nico gets audio. He employs the quietest voice he knows and deflects questions about the investigation of the murder. "I came to remember a colleague," he tells the camera, with one foot in his car. It is Barbara who speaks first. "How was it?" She has wrapped herself now in a red silk robe. "Gala," I answer, "in a way. A meeting of all the luminaries." "Did you cry?" "Come on, Barbara. I'm serious." She is leaning forward. Her jaw is set, and there is a savage deadness in her eye. I always marvel that Barbara's anger remains so near at hand. Over the years, her superior access has become a source of intimidation. She knows I am slower to respond, restrained by archaic fears, the dark weight of memory. My parents often fell into robust shouting matches, even occasional brawls. I have such a vivid recollection of one night when I awoke to their disturbance and found that my mother had taken hold of a handful of my father's brillowy red hair while she slapped him with a rolled-up newspaper, as if he were a dog. The aftermath of these quarrels would send my mother to bed for days, where she would lie spent, dwelling with the sensational pain of enormous migraine headaches that required her to remain in a darkened room and left me under an injunction to make no sound. Lacking that kind of refuge now, I move over to a basket of clean laundry Barbara has brought up and begin matching the socks. For a moment we are silent, left to the burbling of the TV and the nighttime noises of the house. A tiny finger of the river runs behind the homes half a block away, and without the traffic you can hear it licking. The furnace kicks in two floors below. On for the first time today, it will spill up through the ducts, a kind of oily effluvium. "Nico was trying hard enough to look unhappy," Barbara finally tells me. "He wasn't very successful if you saw him up close. He was positively radiant. He thinks he's got a shot at Raymond now." "Is that possible?" I sort the socks and shrug. "He's gained a lot of ground with this thing." Barbara, a witness all these years to Raymond's invincibility, is obviously surprised. But the mathematician in her shows, for I can see that she is quickly factoring the new possibilities. She grabs at her hair, gray-flecked and curly, worn in a fashionable shag, and her pretty face takes on the light of curiosity. "What would you do, Rusty, if that happened? If Raymond lost?" "Accept it. What else could I do?" "I mean, for a living." Blue with blue, black with black. It is not easy with only incandescent light. Some years ago I used to talk about leaving the office. That was when I could still imagine myself as a defense lawyer. But I never got around to making that move, and it has been some time since we have spoken at all about my future. "I don't know what I'd do," I tell her honestly. "I'm a lawyer. I'd practice law." "Teach? I don't know. DeLay says he's going to keep me on as chief deputy. Do you believe that?" "No." I take my stockings to my drawer. He was a river of bullshit today. Told me in a very serious tone that the only real primary opponent he had been afraid of was me. You know, as if I would talk Raymond into stepping aside and anointing me successor. "You should have," Barbara says. I look back at her. "Really?" Her enthusiasm, in a way, is not surprising. Barbara has always felt a spouse's disdain for the boss. And besides, all of this comes somewhat at my expense. I'm the one who lacked the nerve to do what everybody else could see was obvious. "I'm not a politician." "Oh, you'd make do," says Barbara. "You'd love to be PA. As I figured, I am tweaked by my wife's superior knowledge of my nature. I decide to sidestep and tell Barbara that this is all academic. Raymond will pull through. Polcaro will finally endorse him, or we'll catch the killer. I nod toward the TV set. And he'll ride into election day with all the media murmuring his name. "How's he going to do that?" asked Barbara. "Do they have a suspect?" "We have shit." "So?" "So Dan LaPranzer and Rusty Savage will work day and night for the next 2 weeks and catch Raymond a killer. That's the strategy. carefully devised. The remote snaps and the TV shrinks to a star. Behind me I hear from Barbara a whinny, a snort. It is not a pleasant sound. When I look back, her eyes, fixed upon me, are stilled to a zero point, an absolute in hatred. "You are so predictable," she says, low and mean. "You're in charge of this investigation?"
"Of course."
"Of course?" "Barbara, I'm the chief deputy prosecuting attorney, and Raymond's running for his life. Who else would handle the investigation? Raymond would do it himself if he weren't campaigning 14 hours a day." It was the prospect of a moment just like this that left me in a state of excruciating unease a couple of days ago, when I realized that I would have to phone Barbara to tell her what had happened. I could not ignore it. That would pretend too much. My call was for the announced purpose of telling Barbara I would be late. The office, I explained, was in an uproar. "Carolyn Pahemas is dead," I added.
"Huh,"
said Barbara. Her tone was one of detached wonder.
"An overdose?"
she asked. I stared at the receiver in my hand, marveling at the depth of this misunderstanding. But I cannot divert her now. Barbara's rage is gathering.
"Tell me the truth," she says. "Isn't that a conflict of interest or something?"
"Barbara, no," she says, standing now. "Answer me. Is that professional for you to be doing this? There are 120 lawyers down there. Can't they find anybody who didn't sleep with her?" I'm familiar with this rise in pitch and descent in tactics. I strive to remain even. "Barbara, Raymond asked me to do it." "Oh, spare me, Rusty. Spare me the high-purpose, noble crap. You could explain to Raymond why you shouldn't do this." "I don't care to. I would be letting him down, and it happens to be none of his business." At this evidence of my embarrassment, Barbara hoots. That, I realize, was poor strategy, a bad moment to tell the truth. Barbara has little sympathy for my secret. If it would not pain her equally, she would put it all on billboards. During the short time that I was actually seeing Carolyn, I did not have, whatever it is, the courage or the decency or the willingness to be disturbed, to confess anything to Barbara. That awaited the end. A week or two after I had become resolved, it all was past. I was home for an early dinner, atoning for the month before when I had been absent almost every evening, my liberty procured with the phony excuse of preparation for a trial, which I ultimately claimed had been continued. Nat had just gone off to his permitted half-hour with the television set, and I somehow became unglued. The moon, the mood, a drink. The psychologists would say a fugue state. I drifted, staring at the dinner table. I took my highball tumbler in my hand, just like one of Carolyn's. And I was reminded of her so powerfully that I was suddenly beyond control. I cried, wept with stormy passion as I sat there, and Barbara knew immediately. She did not think that I was ill. She did not think that it was fatigue or trial stress or tear duct disease. She knew. And she knew that I was crying out of loss, not shame. There was nothing tender about her inquisition, but it was not prolonged. "Who?" I told her. "Was I leaving?" "It was over," I said. "It was short," I said. "It barely happened." Oh, I was heroic. I sat there at my own dining room table with both arms over my face, crying, almost howling into my shirt sleeves. I heard the dishes clank as Barbara stood and began clearing her place. "At least I don't have to ask," she said, "who dropped who?" Later, after I got Nat into bed, I wandered up, shipwrecked and still pathetic, to see her in the bedroom, where she had taken refuge. Barbara was exercising again, with the insipid music on the tape thumping loudly. I watched her bend, do her double-jointed extensions, while I was still in deep disorder. So ravaged, beaten, that my skin seemed the only thing holding me together, a tender husk. I had come in to say something prosaic that I wanted to go on, but that never emerged. The unhindered anger with which she slammed her own body about made it obvious to me, even in my undefended state, that the effort would be wasted. I just watched, perhaps as long as 5 minutes. Barbara never glanced at me, but finally, in the midst of some contortion, she uttered an opinion. "You could have done better." There was a little more which I did not hear. The final word was bimbo. We have gone on from there. In a way, my affair with Carolyn has provided an odd kind of relief. There is a cause now for the effect, an occasion for Barbara's black anger, a reason we do not get along. There is now something to get over, and as a result, a shadowy hope that things may improve. That is, I realize, the issue now, whether we will give up whatever progress has been made. For months, Carolyn has been a demon, a spirit slowly being exorcised from this home. And death has brought her back to life. I understand Barbara's complaint, but I cannot give up what she wants me to. And my reasons are sufficiently personal as to lie within the realm of the unspoken, even the unspeakable. I try a plain and quiet appeal. "Barbara, what difference does it make? You're talking about 2.5 weeks until the primary, that's all. Then it's another routine police case, unsolved homicide. Don't you see what you're doing? To yourself? To me?" "Barbara," I say again. "I knew it," she says. "I knew you'd do something like this. When you called the other day, I could hear it in your voice. You're going to go through everything again, Rusty. You want to. That's the truth, isn't it? You want to. She's dead, and you're still obsessing." "Barbara, Rusty, I have had more than I can take. I won't put up with this." Barbara does not cry on these occasions. She recedes instead into the fiery pit of a volcanic anger. She hurls herself back now to gather her will, bound, as she sits on the bed, within her wide satin sleeves. She grabs a book, the remote control, 2 pillows. Mount St. Helens rumbles, and I decide to leave. I go to the closet and grope for my robe. As I reach the threshold, she speaks behind me. "Can I ask a question?" she says. "Sure." "That I always wanted to ask?" "Sure." "Why did she stop seeing you?" "Carolyn?" "No, the man in the moon." The words have so much bitterness that I wonder if she might spit. I would have thought Barbara's question would be, "Why did I start?" But she apparently decided on her own answers to that long ago. "I don't know," I say. I tend to think I wasn't very important to her. She closes her eyes and opens them. Barbara shakes her head. "You're an asshole," my wife tells me solemnly. "Just get out." I do, quickly. She's been known to throw things. Having nowhere else to go and craving some form of company, I cross the hall to check once more on Nat. His breath is husky and uninterrupted in the deepest phase of sleep, and I sit down on the bed, safe in the dark beneath the protecting arms of Spider-Man. Chapter 5. Monday morning, a day in the life. The commuter coach unleashes the gray flannel flock on the east side of the river. The terminal plaza is surrounded by willows and their skirts greening in the spring. I am in the office before 9 o'clock. From my secretary, Eugenia Martinez, I receive the usual: mail, telephone message slips, and a dark look. Eugenia is obese, single, middle-aged, and, it often seems, determined to get even for it all. She types reluctantly, refuses dictation, and many times a day I will find her staring with immobile, droopy-eyed irritation at the telephone as it rings. Of course, she cannot be fired, or even demoted, because civil service, like concrete, has set. She remains a curse to a decade of chief deputies, having first been stationed here by John White, who did so in order to avoid the carping that would have followed if he'd assigned her to anybody else. On the top of what Eugenia has given me is a leave slip for Tommy Molto, whose absence remains unaccounted for. Personnel wants to dock him as away without leave. I make a note to talk to Mac about this and graze through my communications. The docket room has provided me with a printout naming 13 individuals released from state custody in the last 2 years whose cases had been prosecuted by Carolyn. A handwritten note says that the underlying case files have been delivered to her office. I position the computer run in the center of my desk so that I will not forget. With Raymond out most of the day on campaign appearances, I resolve much of what the PA would ordinarily be faced with. I call the shots on case prosecutions, immunities, plea bargains, and deal with the investigative agencies. This morning I will preside over a charging conference in which we will decide on the phrasing and merits of all of this week's indictments. This afternoon I have a meeting about last week's fiasco, in which a police undercover bought from a Drug Enforcement Administration agent in disguise. The two drew guns and badges on each other and demanded surrender. Their backups became involved too, so that in the end, 11 law enforcement officers were standing on opposite corners shouting obscenities and waving their pistols. Now we are having meetings. The coppers will tell me the feds do everything in secret. The DEA agent in charge will insinuate that any confidence the police department learns is up for sale. In the meantime, I am supposed to find somebody to prosecute for killing Carolyn Polhemus. Someone else may be looking, too. Near 9:30, I get a call from Stu Dubinsky from the Trib. During the campaign, Raymond answers most press calls himself. He does not want to miss the free ink or draw criticisms that he is losing his hold on the office. But Stu is probably the best courthouse reporter we have. He gets most of his facts straight, and he knows the boundaries. I can talk to him. "So what's new on Carolyn?" he asks. The way he shorthands the murder with her name disconcerts me. Carolyn's death is already receding from the ranks of tragedy to become one more ugly historic event. I cannot, of course, tell Stu that nothing is doing. Word could trail back to Nico, who would use the occasion to blast us again. "Prosecuting attorney Raymond Horgan has no comment," I say. "Would the PA care to comment on another piece of information?" This, whatever it is the real motive for Stu's call. "I hear something about a high-level defection. From the homicide section? Sound familiar?" That would be Molto. After Nico left, Tommy, his second-in-command, became acting head of the section. Horgan refused to give him the job permanently, suspecting that sooner or later something like this would come to pass. I contemplate for a moment the fact that the press is already sniffing. No good. Not at all. I see from the way Dubinsky has lined up the questions how this will run. One high-ranking deputy is killed, another, who should be in charge of the investigation, quits. It will sound as if the office is on the verge of chaos. "Same response," I tell him. "Quote the PA." Stu makes a sound. He is bored. "Off the record?" I ask. "Sure." "How good is your information?" I want to know how close we are to reading about this.
So-so. Guy who always thinks he knows more than he does. I figure this has got to be Tommy Molto. He and Nico are hand in glove, right?"
Stu clearly does not have enough to run. I avoid his question. "What does DeLaGuardia tell you?" I ask.
"He says he has no comment."
"Come on, Rusty," Dubinsky says. "What gives?" "Stu, off the record, I do not have the most fucked-up idea where Tommy Molto is. But if he's holding hands with Nico, why won't the candidate tell you that?"
"You want a theory?"
"Sure."
"Maybe Nico has him out there investigating the case on his own."
"Think about that one.
DeLaGuardia catches killer. How's that for a headline?"
The notion is absurd. A private murder investigation could too easily end up an impediment to the police. Obstruction of justice is bad politics. But as ridiculous as it is, the sheer flair of the idea makes it sound like Nico. And Stu is not the kind to float loony notions. He works off information.
"Do I take it," I ask, "that this is part of your rumor, too?"
"No comment," says Stu. We laugh at each other before I hang up the phone. Immediately, I make some calls. I leave a message with Loretta, Raymond's secretary, that I have to speak with him whenever he phones in. I try to find Mac, the administrative deputy, to talk about Molto. Not in, I'm told. I leave another message. Then, with a few minutes before the charging conference, I venture down the hall to Carolyn's office. This place already has a desolate air. The Empire desk, which Carolyn commandeered from Central Services, has been swept clean, and the contents of the drawers, two old compacts, soup mix, a package of napkins, a cable-knit sweater, a pint bottle of peppermint schnapps, have been pitched into a cardboard box, along with Carolyn's diplomas and bar certificates, which were formerly clustered on the walls. Cartons called in from the warehouse are pyramided in the middle of the room, giving the office an air of obvious disuse, and the dust gathered in a week's inactivity has its own faintly corrupt smell. I pour a glass of water in the wilting greenery and dust some of the leaves. Carolyn's caseload was made up primarily of sexual assaults. According to the codes on the file jackets, there are, by my count, 22 such cases awaiting indictment or trial, which I find in the top drawers of her old oak file cabinet. Carolyn claimed a special sympathy with the victims of these crimes, and over time I found that her commitment was more genuine than at first I had believed. When she talked about the reviving terrors these women experienced, the glittery surfaces receded from Carolyn and revealed alternating moods of tenderness and rage. But there are in these cases also an element of the bizarre. An intern at U Hospital who gave a number of female patients a physical which ended with insertion of his own instrument. One victim received this treatment on three separate occasions before she was moved to complain. The girlfriend of a suspect who, on her second day of questioning, admitted that she had met him when he cut through the screen door of her apartment and forced himself on her. When he put the knife down, she said, he had seemed like such a nice young man. Like many others, I suspected Carolyn of more than a passing fascination with this aspect of her work as well, and I examine the case files with the hope that there will be a pattern I can seize on. We will be able to charge that it was actually some cultish ceremony that was duplicated 6 days ago in Carolyn's loft apartment, or a brutal mimicry of an offense in which Carolyn somehow displayed too obvious a voyeuristic interest. But there is none of that. The 13 names lead nowhere. The new files disgorge no clues. It is now time for the charging conference, but something is nagging at me. When I look again at the computer printout, I recognize that there is one case I have not come across yet. A B file, as we call it, referring to the subsection of the state criminal code addressed to bribery of law enforcement officials. Carolyn seldom handled anything outside her domain, and B files, which are so-called special investigation cases, were directly under my supervision when this case was assigned. At first, I assumed the B designation was the usual computer mess-up, maybe an included charge. But there is no companion case. In fact, this one is listed as an unsub, unknown subject, which usually means a non-arrest investigation. I go through her drawers quickly, one more time, and check down in my office. I have my own printout of B cases, but this one isn't there. In fact, it seems to have been generally obliterated from the computer docketing system, except for Carolyn's call. I make a note on my pad. B file? Pohemus? Eugenia is standing in the doorway.
Oh, man, she says. Where you been? I been looking for you. Mr. Big Cheese called back.
Mr. Big Cheese, of course, is Raymond Horgan.
I was looking all over. He left a message to meet him at the Delancey Club, 1:30.
Raymond and I have many of these meetings during the campaign. I catch him after a luncheon, before a speech, to bring him up to speed on the office.
How about Mac? Did we hear anything?
Eugenia reads the message.
He crossed the street all morning.
Observing, no doubt, watching some of the newer deputies do their stuff during the morning call in the central branch. I ask Eugenia to set back the charging conference half an hour, then I head over to the courthouse to find Mac. On the second floor, the central branch session is held. The branch courts are where arrested persons make their first formal court appearance to set bail, where misdemeanors are tried, and preliminary evidentiary hearings are held in felony cases. An assignment to one of the branches is usually the second or third stopping-off place for a deputy, after time in appeals or the complaint and warrant section. I worked this courtroom for 19 months before I was sent to felony review, and I try to come back as little as possible. It is here that crime always seemed most real, the air quivering with a struggling agony at the brink of finding voice. In the hallway outside, two enormous central courtrooms, there is a churning mass, like my imaginings of the crushed poor in the steerage bowels of the old ocean-going vessels. Mothers and girlfriends and brothers are here, weeping and crying out over the young men detained in the granite lockup that abuts the courtroom. Lawyers of a kind move about hustling clients in the subverted tones of scalpers, while the state defenders shout out the names of persons whom they have never met and whom they will be defending in a moment. The prosecutors are shouting too, searching for each of the arresting officers on a dozen cases, hoping to enhance the slender knowledge provided by police reports prepared in a deliberately elliptical fashion, the better to hinder cross-examination. Inside the vaulted courtroom, with its red marble pillars and oaken buttresses and straight-backed pews, the tumult continues, a persistent din. Situated closer to the front so they will not fail to hear their cases called, prosecutors and defense lawyers haggle amiably over prospective plea bargains. Beside the judge's bench, six or seven attorneys are clustered around the docket clerk, handing in appearance forms, examining court files, and urging the clerk to pass their case forward to be called next. The cops, most of them, are lined up in pairs against the grimy walls, many of them in from the 12-to-8 shift for the bail hearings on their nighttime collars, sipping coffee and rolling on the balls of their feet to keep themselves awake. And far to one side of the courtroom there is a continuing clamor from the lockup, where defendants in custody await their appearance, one or two of them inevitably shouting obscenities at the bailiffs or their attorneys, complaining about the cramped conditions back there and the indecent odors from the commode. The rest moan occasionally, or bang on the bars. Now, at the dead end of the morning call, the streetwalkers, in their halter tops and shorts, are being arraigned, tried, fined, and sent back out on the street in time for sleep and another night's work. Usually they are represented in groups by two or three lawyers, but every now and then a pimp, to economize, will take on the assignment himself. That is occurring right now as some jerk in a flamingo-colored suit goes on about police brutality. Mac takes me into the cloakroom, where no coats are hung. No visitor would be so cavalier as to leave a valuable garment unguarded in this company. The room is completely empty, except for a court reporter's shorthand typewriter and a huge dining-room chandelier in a plastic bag, which is evidence, undoubtedly, in a case that is going to be called. She asks me what is up. "Tell me what Carolyn Polhemus was doing with a B-file," I say. "I had no idea that Carolyn was interested in crimes above the waist," says Mac, an old line. She beams up from her wheelchair, everybody's favorite smartass, brassy and irreverent. She makes a number of suggestions concerning the B-file, all of which I've already tried. "It doesn't figure," she finally admits. As Chief Administrative Deputy, Lydia McDougall is in charge of personnel, procurement, and the deployment of staff. It is a lousy, thankless job with a nice-sounding title, but Lydia is accustomed to adversity. She has been a paraplegic since shortly after we started in this office together nearly 12 years ago. It was one of those early winter nights where the mist is half snow. Lydia was driving. Her first husband, Tom, was killed in the plunge into the river. In the general run of things, I would say Mac is probably the finest lawyer in this office, organized, shrewd, gifted in court. Over the years, she has even learned to use the chair to advantage before a jury. There are some tragedies that run so deep that our comprehension of them is evolutionary at best. As the jurors get a couple of days to think about what it would be like to have their legs flapping around, loose as flags, as they listen to this woman, handsome, forceful, good-humored, absorb the wedding ring, the the casual mention of her baby, observe the fact that she is, impossibly, normal, they are full of admiration, and, as we all should be, hope. Next September, Mac will become a judge. She already has party slating and will run in the primary unopposed. The general election will be an automatic. There are not, apparently, a lot of people who feel they can beat a lawyer with support from women's groups, the handicapped, law and order types, and the city's three major bar associations. "Why don't you ask Raymond about the file?" she finally suggests. I make a noise. Horgan is not a detail man. He is unlikely to know anything about an individual case. And these days I am reluctant to advise him of problems. He is always looking for someone to blame. Going down the corridor to the next courtroom, where Mac is scheduled to observe, I talk to her about Tommy Molto and the problem of his unaccounted-for status. If we fire Molto, Nico will make capital, alleging that Horgan is on a witch hunt for DeLay's friends. If we keep Tommy on the staff, we increase Nico's profit from the defection. We decide, at last, that he will be placed on unauthorized leave, an employment category which previously did not exist. I tell Mac I would feel more comfortable about this if somebody I trusted had seen Molto alive. Let's get a posse out. We have one deputy PA dead already. If some lady finds little pieces of Molto in her trash tomorrow morning, I'd like to be able to say we'd been searching high and low. It is Mac's turn. She makes a note. His Honor Laren Little, his large dark face full of wiliness and majesty, is the first to notice me. A black man, in a club in which only whites were members until 3 years ago, the judge shows no sign of yielding to the atmosphere. He is at ease among the leather club chairs and the servers in green livery. Laren is Raymond's former law partner. In those days, they were agitators, defending draft dodgers and possessors of marijuana, and most of the local black militants, as well as a paying clientele. I tried one case against Laren before he took the bench, really just a juvenile proceeding against a very rich kid from the West Shore suburbs who liked to break into the homes of his parents' friends. Laren was an imposing figure of robust stature, shrewd and bullying with witnesses, and possessed of a rhetorical range of operatic dimension. He could adopt a refined demeanor and then move with the next utterance into the round oratory of a pork-chop preacher or squealing ghettoese. The jury rarely noticed there was another lawyer in the courtroom. Raymond made the break for politics first. Laren managed the campaign, quite visibly, and brought out black votes in substantial numbers. 2 years later, when Raymond thought he could be mayor, Laren joined him on the ticket as a candidate for judge. Laren won, and Raymond lost, and Judge Little suffered for his loyalties. Bolcaro kept him quarantined in the North Branch, where Laren heard traffic cases and rum-dum misdemeanors, usually the job of the appointed magistrates, until Raymond bought his freedom 4 years later with his early and enthusiastic endorsement of Mayor Bolcaro's re-election campaign. Laren has been a downtown felony judge ever since, a ruthless autocrat in his courtroom, and, notwithstanding his friendship with Raymond, the sworn enemy of the deputy prosecuting attorneys. The saying is that there are two defense lawyers in the courtroom, and the one who's hard to beat is wearing a robe. In spite of that, Laren remains an active force in Raymond's campaigns. The Code of Judicial Conduct now prohibits him from taking any official role, but he is still a member of Raymond's inner group, the men from Horgan's years in law school and his early time in practice, whose intimacy with Raymond has filled me at moments with a kind of adolescent pining. Laren, Mike Duke, the managing partner at a massive firm downtown, Joe Riley from the first, these are the people Raymond falls back on at these times. To Mike Duke goes the duty of overseeing campaign financing. It has proved a more daunting task this year than in the past when Raymond was without significant opponents. Then, Raymond would not take part in a campaign solicitation of any kind, for fear that it might compromise his independence. But those scruples this year have been laid aside. Raymond has been through a number of these meetings of late, preening for the checkbook liberals, elegant-looking gentlemen like the group assembled here today, showing them that he is still the same sleek instrument of justice that he was a decade ago. Raymond delivers his campaign speech in conversational tones, awaiting the moment that first he and then the judge can be called away so that Mike, in their absence, can apply the squeeze. That is my function here today. I will be Raymond's excuse to leave. He introduces me and explains that he has to catch up with the office. In this atmosphere, I am pure flunky. No one even thinks of asking me to sit down, and only Judge Little bothers to stand to shake my hand. I remain behind the table in the cigar smoke while there is a final round of handshakes and bluff jokes, then head out behind Raymond as he grabs a mint by the doorway.
"What's going on?" he asks me as soon as we are past the doorman and beneath the club's green awning.
You can feel, just since the morning, that the air is starting to soften. My blood stirs. It is going to be spring. When I tell him about Dubinsky's call, he makes no effort to hide his irritation.
"Let me just catch either one of them fucking around like that."
He means Nico and Molto. We are walking briskly down the street now toward the county building.
"What kind of crap is this? An independent investigation."
"Raymond, this is a reporter thinking out loud. There's probably nothing to it."
"There better not be," he says.
I start to tell Raymond about the debacle between the police and the DEA, but he does not let me finish.
"Where are we on Caroline ourselves?" he asks.
I can see that the speculation on Molto's activities has reheated Raymond's desire for results in our own investigation. He machine guns questions.
"Do we have a hair and fiber report? How long will it be? Have we gotten any better news on fingerprints? How about a report from the state index on sexual offenders Carolyn prosecuted?"
When I tell Raymond that all of this is in the offing, but that I spent the last 3 hours in the charging conference, he stops dead in the street. He is furious.
"Damn it, Rusty!"
His color is high and his brow flexed down angrily over his eyes.
"I told you the other day, give this investigation top priority. That's what it deserves. DeLaGuardia is eating me alive with this thing, and we owe Carolyn as much. Let Mac run the office. She's more than capable. She can watch DEA and the coppers urinate all over each other. She can second-guess indictments. You stay on this. I want you to run out every ground ball, and do it in a goddamn orderly fashion. Do it. Act like a fucking professional."
I look down the street, both ways. I do not see anyone I know. I am 39 years old, I think. I have been a lawyer 13 years. Raymond walks ahead in silence. Finally, he looks back at me, shaking his head. I expect a further complaint about my performance, but instead he says,
"Man, those guys were assholes."
Raymond, I see, did not enjoy lunch. In the county building, Goldie, the little white-haired elevator operator who sits all day with an empty car, waiting to take Raymond and the county commissioners up and down, tosses his stool inside and folds his paper. I have begun to broach the subject of the missing B-file, but I hold off while we are in the elevator. Goldie and Nico were the best of pals. I even saw Goldie break with protocol and high Nico up and down on one or two occasions. That was the kind of touch Nico adored, the official elevator. His destiny. Nico maintained a noble poker face as Goldie scanned the lobby to be sure the coast was clear. Once we are in the office, I trail behind. Various deputies come forward to get a word or two with Raymond, some with problems, a number who simply want the news from the campaign front. On a couple of occasions, I explain that I have been through Carolyn's docket. I do this in a desultory fashion, since I have no desire to confess to further failures, and Raymond loses the thread of what I am telling him as he moves between conversations. "There's a file missing," I say again. "She had a case we can't account for." This finally catches Raymond's attention. We have come through the side door to his office.
"Well, what kind of case? Do we know anything about it?"
"We know it was logged in as a bribe case, a B. Nobody seems to know what happened to it. I asked Mac. I checked my own records." Raymond studies me for a second. Then his look becomes absent. "Where am I supposed to be at 2 o'clock? He asks me. When I tell him that I have no idea, he shouts for Loretta, his secretary, calling her name until she appears. Raymond, it turns out, is due at a bar committee meeting on criminal procedure. He is supposed to outline various reforms in the state sentencing scheme that he has been calling for as part of his campaign. A press release has been issued, reporters and TV crews will be there, and he is already late.
Shit, says Raymond, shit.
He stomps around the office saying shit. I try again. Anyway, the case is still in the computer system.
Did she call Cody?
He asks me.
Carolyn? No, Loretta.
I don't know, Raymond. He screams again for Loretta.
Call Cody. Did you call him? For Christ's sake, call him. We'll get somebody to go down there.
Raymond looks at me.
Sot sits on the car phone and you can never get through. Who the hell does he talk to?
I thought maybe you had heard something about this case. Maybe you remember something. Raymond is not listening. He has fallen into an easy chair, angled against what the deputies irreverently refer to as Raymond's wall of respect. A stretch of plaster solid with plaques and pictures and other mementos of great triumphs or honors. Bar associations awards, courtroom artists' sketches, political cartoons. Raymond has that aging look again, wandering, pensive, a man who has seen things unravel.
God, what a fucking disaster this is.
Every campaign, Laren has told me to ask a deputy to take a leave so that I have somebody running things full time, and we've always been able to scrape by without it. But this is out of control. There's too goddamn much to do and nobody in charge. Do you know that we haven't taken a poll in 2 months? 2 weeks to the election and we have no idea where we are. With who? He folds his hand against his mouth and shakes his head. It is not anxiety he shows so much as distress. Raymond Horgan, Kendall County prosecuting attorney, has lost his ability to cope. A moment passes between us, completely silent. I am not inclined, however, after the pasting I took out on the street, to be reverential. After 13 years in government, I know how to be a bureaucrat, and I want to be sure my butt is covered with Raymond on the subject of the missing file. Anyway, I say yet again, I don't know what significance to attach to it. I don't know if it's misfiled or something sinister. Raymond stares.
Are you talking about that file again?
I do not get a chance to answer. Loretta announces a phone call and Raymond takes it. Alejandro Stern, the defense lawyer who is the chairman of the bar committee, is on the line. Raymond begs apologies, says he's been wrapped up in discussions of that bizarre episode between DEA and the local police and is on the way. When he puts the phone down, he screams again for Cody.
I'm right here,
Cody announces. He has come in the side door.
Great.
Raymond starts in one direction, then the other.
Where the hell is my coat?
Cody already has it. I wish Raymond luck. Cody opens the door. Raymond goes through it and comes right back.
Loretta, where's my speech?
Cody, it turns out, has that too. Nonetheless, Raymond continues to his desk. He opens a drawer and hands me a folder on his way out again. It is the B file.
We'll talk,
he promises me. And with Cody hard behind him, goes running down the hall. Chapter 6. Somehow the boy, Wendell, became important, I said to Robinson. To us, I mean. To me, at least. It's hard to explain, but somehow he was part of this thing with Carolyn. He was an unusual child, big for his age, and he had the ambling clumsiness of some big children, a thick, almost oafish appearance. He was not so much slow as dulled. I asked one of the psychiatrists for an explanation, as if one is needed, and he said of this 5-year-old, he's depressed. Wendell McGaffin, during the pendency of his mother's case, had been moved from the county shelter to a foster home. He saw his father every day, but never his mother. After the usual disputes in court, Carolyn and I were given permission to speak with him. Actually, at first, we did not talk to him at all. We sat in on sessions he had with the psychiatrists, who introduced us to Wendell. Wendell would play with the toys and figures that the shrink had around the room, and the shrink would ask Wendell whether he had any thoughts on different topics, which, almost inevitably, Wendell did not. The shrink, named Mattingly, said that Wendell had not, in his weeks there, asked once about his mother. and as a result they had not raised the subject. Wendell liked Carolyn right from the start. He brought her the dolls. He made remarks to her. He directed her attention to birds, trucks, objects passing outside the window. On our third or fourth visit, Carolyn told Wendell that she wanted to talk to him about his mother. The shrink appeared alarmed, but Wendell gripped his doll with both hands and asked, "What about?" So it progressed, 20-30 minutes a day. The shrink was openly impressed and eventually asked Carolyn's permission to remain during their interviews, and over a period of weeks the story was told in snatches and mumbled remarks, disordered offhand answers to questions Carolyn had asked often days before. Wendell showed no real emotion other than his hesitation. Usually he would stand in front of Carolyn with both his hands gripped hard around the midsection of a doll, at which he stared unflinchingly. Carolyn would repeat what he had told her and ask him more. Wendell would nod or shake his head or not answer at all. Now and then there were his explanations. "It hurt. I cried. She said I shouldn't be quiet."
"She wanted you to be quiet?"
"Yes. She said I shouldn't be quiet." From another person, the repetition, particularly, might have seemed cruel. But Carolyn somehow seemed to have a need to know that was, in some measure, selfless. Not long before the trial, Carolyn and the shrink decided that the county would not call Wendell to the witness stand unless it was an absolute necessity. The confrontation with his mother, she said, would be too much. But even with that decision made, Carolyn continued to meet with Wendell, to draw more and more from him.
"It's hard to explain," I told Robinson, "the way she looked at this kid. Into him, almost. That intense, that earnest. I never figured her to be the type to have any kind of rapport with children. And when she did, I was astounded."
It made her mystery so much larger. She seemed like some Hindu goddess, containing all feelings in creation. Whatever wild, surging, libidinal rivers Carolyn undammed in me by her manner and appearance, there was something about the tender attention she showed this needy child that drew me over the brink, that gave my emotions a melting, yearning quality that I took to be far more significant than all my priapic heat. When she took on the quiet, earnest tone and leaned toward dear, slow, hurting Wendell, I was, whatever my regrets, full of love for her. A wild love. Desperate and obsessive and willfully blind. Love, as love at its truest is, with no sense of the future. Love beguiled by the present and unable to derive the meaning of signs. One day I talked to Mattingly about the way Carolyn had worked with the boy. "It was extraordinary, wasn't it?" I asked. "Amazing, inexplicable." I wanted to hear him praise her, but Mattingly took my comments instead as a clinical inquiry, as if I was asking what could account for this phenomenon. He drew meditatively on his pipe.
"I've thought about that," he said.
Then his look became troubled, recognizing, I suppose, that he was liable to give offense or be misjudged himself. But he went on, "And I believe," he said, "that in some small way she must remind him of his mother." The trial went well. Mrs. McGaffin was represented by Alejandro Stern, Sandy outside the courtroom, an Argentinian Jew, a Spanish gentleman, courtly, combed, and perfect with his soft accent and his manicure. He is a mannerly, fastidious trial lawyer, and we decided to follow his low-key approach. We put in our physical evidence, the doctor's testimony, and their test results. Then we offered the fruits of the search. With that, the county rested. Sandy called a psychiatrist who described Colleen McGaffin's gentle nature. Then he showed how good a lawyer he was by reversing the usual order of presentation. The defendant testified first, denying everything. Then her husband came to the stand, weeping unbearably as he described the death of his first child, Wendell's fall, which he insisted he had witnessed, and his wife's devotion to their son. A fine trial lawyer always has a latent message to the jury. too prejudicial or improper to speak aloud, whether it's a racist appeal when black victims identify white defendants, or the no-big-deal manner that a lawyer like Stern takes when the crime is only an attempt. In this case, Sandy wanted the jury to know that her husband forgave Colleen McGaffin. And if he could, why couldn't they do that too? In a kind of professional salvation, I found that in the courtroom I could almost wall myself from Carolyn. I enjoyed extended periods of concentration and would wake to her presence beside me and to the grip of my obsession, almost with surprise. But this work of will came at a heavy price. Outside, I was largely useless. To perform the most routine tasks, talking to witnesses, gathering exhibits, required that all my energies be directed to a frozen inattention. Do not think about her. Please do not think about her now. I did. I moved about in a spaced-out reality, vacillating among various lurid fantasies and moments of intense self-rebuke, an instance when she was present, in which I simply, helplessly gawked. Finally, I told Robinson, we were there one night, working in her office. The defense case was nearly over. Darrell had begun his testimony, and the pathos of this man's feckless inability to deal with anything that had happened was, in truth, terribly moving. Carolyn was going to do the cross-examination, and she was high. The courtroom was full of reporters. There were stories about the case on a couple of the TV stations most nights. And the cross itself was exciting because it required a kind of surgical skill. Darrell had to be destroyed as a witness, but not as a human being. The jury's sympathy would never leave him, for he was, in the end, not doing anything less than most of us would do, trying to save what was left of his family. So Carolyn was lingering over this cross, practicing it, modulating it, talking it out, flashing in front of me like a coin turning in the air. She was in her stocking feet, and a full skirt that twirled slightly around her, whenever she pivoted in the narrow space. She was pacing briskly as she worked through the tone and the questions. And there are wrappers from our fast food dinner on the desk, and a scatter of various records. Darrell's time and attendance sheets from work to show that he's too busy to know what is up at home. Medical reports on the child. Statements from his teachers and an aunt. And we are setting up each question. No, no, softer, softer. Mr. McGaffin, you couldn't know that Wendell showed his bruises at school? Like that. Maybe three questions. Do you know Beverly Morrison? Well, would it refresh your recollection to know that she was Wendell's teacher? Did you know that Ms. Morrison discussed Wendell's physical condition with your wife on the evening of November 7th of last year? Softly, she says. Softly, right, I say. Don't come too close to him, and don't move too much in the courtroom. You don't want to seem angry. And Carolyn is excited, and she reaches across the desk, very high, and grabs both my hands. It's going to be so good, she says. And then her eyes, which are quite green, stay on me a little longer, just enough so that I know we've suddenly left the trial. And I say, and I have never said a word out loud up to that moment, I just say, as hollow and pathetic as I feel, what the hell is going on, Carolyn? And she smiles for the fleetest instant, but with a stunning radiance, and says, not now. And goes right back to talking out the cross. Not now. Not now. I caught the last bus back to Nearing that night and sat in the dark, pondering as we flashed under the streetlights. Not now. I haven't decided. I have. It's good. It's bad. I'm uncertain. I want to let you down easy. But at least there was something. I gradually recognized the significance of our communication. I was not mad. I was not caught up with something imaginary. Something was happening. We had been talking about something. And that turbulent, lost unease of mine began to change. There in the bus, as I sat in the rear, in a pit of darkness, my obsessions now took on a sabering quality, and knowing that I had entered the region of the real, I began to feel, simply, fear. Chapter 7 Studio B, it says outside the door. I enter a large open space the size of a small gymnasium. There is a mustardy quality to the lighting here. The walls are yellow tile, and they seem vaguely luminescent. The feeling is very much like Nat's grade school. A row of sinks, floor-to-ceiling compartments of white birch that are apparently student lockers. One young man is working at his easel by the windows. I spent, of course, many years around the U. Probably, if I had to get down to this kind of dismal estimate, the happiest time of my life. But I doubt that I ever entered the Art Center before, especially if you do not count the adjacent auditorium, where Barbara, on occasion, brought me to attend some plays. For an instant I am perplexed that I am here. Better to send LaPranzer, I think clearly. Then I speak. Marty Pohemus? The boy turns from the easel, some anxious sign working through his expression. Are you from the police? PA's office. I offer my hand and give my name. Marty tosses his brush down on a table where tubes of acrylic paint and round white bottles of gesso are randomly set. He picks up his shirt tail to wipe his hand before he shakes. Marty is an art student, all right, a pimply kid, with lots and lots of hair, loose, brass-colored ringlets. He has spots of paint all over his clothing and a gruel of paint and just plain dirt under his long fingernails. They said somebody else might come to see me, Marty tells me. He is a nervous sort, eager to please. He asks if I want coffee, and we go to a drip pot back near the door. Marty